This is the Karamcast, episode 23. I am here in Chemical Light Factory Studios in Hollywood, California, with my guest and longtime colleague, Truffle Jones. How are you tonight, Truffle?
Very well. And yourself, sir?
I'm good. I'm going to be heading to Canada shortly, where I hear they've had a very mild winter, unlike in Europe, where they've had some sort of freakish ice age.
They have indeed. In fact, Iceland is having the worst snowfall they've had since 1984, if you can imagine that.
1984 doesn't seem that long ago.
It's pretty long ago, and particularly for a country with the word ice right in the name of it, for them to be having a record snowfall seems at odds with the brown Christmas that most of us had here in North America.
Do you know that in Europe right now, there are villages that have 4 or 5 meters of snow? There are stop signs that are covered over by snow.
What do you make of that? Because is it, you know, we hear about global warming, and then we hear about, well, maybe there's no global warming, and we have half of the hemisphere is, or I guess in this hemisphere we've had a very mild winter, and then in the other hemisphere it's been just like balls on snowfall.
Well, I was watching Encounters at the End of the World the other day by Werner Herzog, who we'll talk about a little bit later, and They're showing these time-lapse images from space of the icebergs in Antarctica. And they're moving around like jello. I'm talking areas that are the size of Texas are just flopping around and moving rapidly and sinking and melting like ice cubes in a cup of water. And when you have something the size of Texas, of which the surface is literally the tip of the iceberg, melt, things are going to happen around the planet. And these things are happening quickly. So let's not make this a global warming episode.
Please.
However, let it be said, no, global warming is not a conspiracy by granola-eating hippies that are trying to work with scientists in order to bring down the economy. Far more likely, anything that has made you second guess global warming is subsidized and paid for by an oil company who would like to figure out a way to hide their pollution and emissions as long as possible while keeping the status quo as it is, which is very, very lucrative for them.
Is there perhaps another option at work here? And the one that I want to throw out, because this came up recently, we know, we keep finding on this planet, we find these remains of lost civilizations, not necessarily in the jungles or in crazy places like in the Balkans, which you and I talked about recently, but, you know, off the shore of Japan, they found things. Off the shores of India, they found things, towers and ziggurats and so forth. And so all of that kind of lends itself to saying, all right, well, as advanced as our civilization is today, maybe not too long ago, there are other civilizations that something covered them over in water. Could this maybe not be the first episode on the planet Earth where we're going through this cycle of icebergs melting and water levels rising and weather patterns changing? I mean, are we that centric to ourselves to think this is the first time it's happening?
Right. There will definitely be U.S. cities that are one day discovered and we think of them as Atlantis or a place that used to be really great for chowder. They just discovered a huge, one of the largest ancient villages that I think is a contemporary of Stonehenge's near Orkney.
Right.
They just found it. They just figured that out.
They said it was a find of a lifetime.
Find of a lifetime, like a city from ancient times. Is that ancient?
How about really, really old? For the purposes of this podcast, just super old, man.
Older than the shitty indie music that we hear everywhere these days.
That's right. Absolutely true.
When did indie music, I mean, I've said this before, I think I said this in episode 4 where I asked when did indie music become hand claps and glockenspiels and post electro synth crap, but am I old or is it just
you're that, not old
it's, is it everywhere the same thing?
Indie music has become, you know, musiczeitgeist.com, which you know, we both contribute to. It was a struggle last year for me to actually go through all of the releases and come up with, it was easy to find 10 or 20 really great records, but at least in terms of indie rock, it was next to impossible to find things that were really barnstorming or just really exciting. And I think indie music is just, you know, music goes through cycles. And right now, indie is at that cycle where it's just really boring. I mean, hand claps and glockenspiel and whatever is just a euphemism for boring.
Yeah.
Far more interesting is a lot of people are talking about EDM, electronic dance music, which is back again from the 90s.
Or we used to call it IDM, intelligent dance music. Anyway.
That's less interesting to me than what's going on with just straight up pop music. You know, the stuff that you hear on the radio is so sublimely produced, and the teams of writers and producers that tackle these tracks and the way that the BPMs are all set so the songs can be mixed together easily in the club or on a radio station, and the way that all these contemporary artists are guest starring on all of their contemporaries' tracks, particularly if you have DJs who previously were kind of nameless entities. It would be like, oh, he's the famous DJ, I've never heard of him. Now you have all these top vocalists appearing and rotating on all these tracks from various DJs.
Wait, so I want you to clarify what you're saying right now. Is this the archaeology episode? Are we digging up these like structures from the past again, that to say, look how magnificent these older societies were, and they were so much more intelligent and advanced than us? Are we talking about, you know, the old school 70s and 80s tracks, or what are we talking about here?
I think it just became the archaeology episode. I think, listen, nothing that's old is necessarily any better than anything that's new, but I think you really, in order to move forward into the future, you got to keep one foot in the past. And if you choose to ignore your past, as the old expression goes, those who don't learn the history are doomed to repeat those same mistakes. And I think when you look at whether we're talking about ancient civilizations or we're talking about politics or we're talking about music, it all becomes relevant. What came before? And there's teams of producers that spend all day, every day with their assistants going through the top 10 tracks in each format of every single year since commercial radio existed. And then they just pull out, what are all those chord changes and what are all those melodies? And they take them and they drop them into what they're doing today to guarantee that they're going to have another hit on their hands.
But I'm always suspicious of all of that. What's the top 10 best tracks of any given year, or let alone the Grammys, which is such a farce. But I mean, there's a lot of other music too. I'm not talking about Kiss and the Ramones. I'm talking like amazing 20th century composition. Like, I'm talking about contemporary jazz artists that are doing weird crossover stuff with electronica, or using Qawwali singers to emulate, you know, electronic Bhangra sort of collaborations with whomever else it might be. Like, there's all that too. I actually couldn't believe on the Grammys this year when they had Deadmau5 on there, but that's only because he wears like a funny hat and, you know, he had a song in some popular movie. I mean, it took the Grammys frickin' what, how many years to even acknowledge electronic music?
Of course.
I mean, I don't know if we're kind of just going in circles here, but you first started bringing up electronic dance music.
Well, just because I think that as with so much that we experience, and I think, you know, you and I tend to side a little bit more with the Adbuster side of any commercial equation, but electronic dance music or IDM or EDM, whatever you want to call it or whatever it was called, it's just become the latest marketing thing. And so every corporation that has a product to sell has attached their wagon to that particular trend right now. And so that supposedly is like the big cool thing, because, oh, look at Electric Daisy Carnival, and oh my God, look what's going on with Ultra Festival and so forth. But you and I have seen all of that before.
This hurts my stomach a
doesn't
little
it though? But at the same time, everything is one iteration further. We talk a lot about evolution and what changes with each iteration, and everything is just that much more slick and clever. And I'm not denigrating it. I'm actually telling you that I find more to hear and listen to.
Hey, That must be the Newt Gingrich bust just outside our window.
I bet that is.
Why don't we talk about the? Let's get back to this for a sec in a minute. But like, let's talk about why that could be the Newt Gingrich bus right outside our window.
The Newt Gingrich bus was broken down on Sunset Boulevard, Sunset and Crescent Heights.
Oh, so like literally the same place where they caught that arsonist that was burning Hollywood down.
Correct.
During Christmas.
Yeah, not more than a half hour ago. Right as I was coming over to the studio, it was broken down in the middle of Sunset Boulevard, much like his ratings in the latest polls where he's 10% or less. Well, hey, you know, he had to walk through the door. Yeah, so that could have been his bus that we just heard right there.
And we got a notice that the President Obama mobiles of all forms in chopper form, land-based, water-based form, were going to be traversing the Los Angeles landscape today.
Yeah, looking for money.
Looking for money. Looking trolling for around money. For money.
Yep.
The giant robot. Marp. Okay, so can I say this as we talk about electronic music? Before we all forget, and it gets to the point where we hate it again, and we've all gone back to listening to Smells Like Teen Spirit in earnest, some of the great electronic artists that I listened to growing up were Pete Namlook, Klaus Schulze, Tangerine Dream, Pierre Henry.
Oh, Pierre Henry, yeah, for sure.
John Cage. Listen to that stuff. Like, it's deep. Camel. Of course, Aphex Twin, Richard James.
Yep.
Future Sound of London. Seafeel. There's all different eras and times. I mean, there's Richard Hawtin's, like, Plastic Man is his working name. And anyways, that stuff was like really key and seminal. And I had a thing called Automated Gardens where we did a lot of this sort of infinite loop repetition kind of stuff. And I think about that often because, you know, we were recording records where a track lasted 65 minutes.
Right.
And it was meant to be a journey through the subconscious. And we would build like three-dimensional audio, auditory environments. Like you would be, at first you'd hear yourself in a boat paddling across a lake, and then there'd be a sea monster and you would jump out of the boat and dive underwater and swim 20,000 leagues under the sea. And it was all represented like with audio, of course, inspired by things like Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon or whatever. But I mean, these days, what they call electronica in 3-minute sound bites, boom, 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 it's just gonna get played out.
And of course it is.
The people that are making it are coming from a good place. And I just hope they keep resisting, like they always have, the mainstream culture and
sure.
always keep pushing it and getting twitchy and glitchy and whatever.
But the difference is, and again, everything we're talking about, everything's cyclical. I mean, country goes in cycles and boy band stuff goes in cycles and so forth. And the cycle this time around is just that a lot of the artists that you mention, let's take Tangerine Dream, for example, because I think probably most people know who Tangerine Dream is. And if you don't, watch the movie Risky Business. They did the most of the score to that, and you'll be, oh, that's Tangerine Dream.
Okay, wait. Let me stop you here for one more second. When the Grammys just played, there were like entire Twitter streams of people going, who the fuck is Paul McCartney?
Right. I just want to add, the difference between then and now is the ability to singularly meld the pop format with this, whatever this other thing is we're calling it, electronic dance music, whatever, and turn it into a pop product. You couldn't, in 1978, put Cher on a Tangerine Dream record and make that a top 10 pop hit. The way today you can take a David Guetta track and put Nicki Minaj on it, and then you get an incredible top 10 hit or top 20 hit, whatever it is right now. That's the difference. And all these other things, the speed ramps and adding the wobbly bass, which is, you know, borrowed from dubstep, all of that is just the composite stew that is available now because you can send tracks across the Atlantic in seconds and so forth. It's not like it was before where you just had someone locked away in a recording studio making this product and then, oh, Paul McCartney happens to be down the hall. Let's get him to come sing on a track. It's all very thought out. It's all very deliberate. It's all very slick.
You sound like you're like really on the inside here with something. Who have you been talking to?
Well, I can't.
What private offices have you hacked your way through the back door into?
You know, if you want to fight the man, you got to become the man.
Right, I got it.
But all of that being said, again, I'm not denigrating. I find it fascinating. We started off talking about indie and hand claps and glockenspiels, and wherever that was going, I got lost. I got lost last year and probably before that.
There's nothing compelling
in that formula. I hate to say formula. There's just nothing compelling when you have a generation of artists who just have been influencing themselves for the last 7-10 years and not breaking any new ground. It's much more exciting to me to listen to the top 40 pop station and hear what these producers are doing, because it's just so clever. And it's just full of earworms, just stuff that sticks in your head for hours later. And I'm more impressed by the artistry of delivering that slick commercial product than I am of the artistry of some kid who's sitting in his room right now with an acoustic guitar writing about breaking up with his girlfriend. One thing that is certainly going to date me and make me sound old, but I really, really always enjoyed it. Back when MTV actually had a little bit of teeth to it, they ran a series of commercials that kind of made fun of themselves. And there was a girl in a laundromat, and she's looking at a camera, and she says, everyone's talking about dance music and electronica. None of that's going to replace real artists. I mean, who pushing a button is going to replace someone like Nine Inch Nails or Beck or The Prodigy? Those are real artists. Screw electronica.
Listen, I think there's a bigger issue going on here. I think the sameness of all of this music we're talking about is actually a direct effect of the very small circles that have been manufactured by Facebook and Google.
No question.
Who are, as we've discussed many times before, have created algorithms that effectively lead to self-reinforcing circles of influence.
Right.
So the reason that kids don't know who Paul McCartney is not because the Beatles are not available. It is not because people don't talk about them all the time. It is because those kids who are being corralled inside of their own self-reinforced social circles by way of Google and Facebook, who are like, no, you can't leave our borders. There's dangerous things out there, monsters and Republicans and pornography and pro-choice. So they keep you inside of these things. And, you know, what are you going to get exposed to but the very things that advertisers who are targeting you are going to expose you to?
Well, that's not really any different, though. Listen, it is different in terms of volume and immediacy, but it's not really any different than, speaking of Paul McCartney, when the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan. I mean, there are plenty of people who didn't know at that time in history in the United States who they were, but it was the only freaking thing you could watch, and everybody else was talking about how you had to watch it, and so everyone watched it. All that did was make the Beatles bigger. The same way that Deadmau5 said on his Facebook page a couple years ago, hey, I'm really digging this guy named Skrillex, maybe you should all check it out, and then the next thing you know, Skrillex has blown up as big as he is. There's really not a lot of difference between that type of Facebook exposure to someone who has thousands and thousands of friends on Facebook and the Beatles being on Ed Sullivan.
But here's the difference. And I thought for a second, you know what, maybe you're completely refuting and proving my argument wrong, because yes, television networks were also a very highly homogenizing form of exposure and social herding and corralling. However, in those days, you could just get away from the TV and suddenly discover a bunch of books in the cellar or toys or something that were just unique and one of a kind, or, you know, antiques. And then you could explore those things for quite some geography before you got stopped and sort of called back to the kennel. Do you know what I'm saying? Now, you can take about 3 or 4 adventurous steps before something pings you and you go back towards the dazzling lights. Am I being too poetic here? I mean,
I don't think you're being too poetic, but I think that's you got to remember who you're talking to. You're talking to
someone. I can't look around and not see a person staring into their frickin' phone.
Except for someone like me.
No, because you've just gotten into it.
I did just get, we'll talk about that for a second. I did just get an iPhone. I had to get either an iPhone or an Android phone for very specific reasons.
You think you've got the strength, but I will tell you that a year from now, you'll be amazed at how little time you've spent looking up.
I 100% don't agree.
You'll see.
And you know, all this technology has been available to me before. You've mentioned on this show, on this podcast before, about how you can't follow me at Twitter. You can't find me on Facebook. You can't, because I just look away. I mean, there's so much. You know, when I'm 60 and 70 and wearing Depends
and wearing Depends
and just like sitting around and my body is gone, I'll have all the time in the world to spend online and watch Netflix and whatever it is that people do when they're incapacitated by their age. But for right now, I'd much rather be out and about and active that way, or, you know, reading those crazy archaic things called books and actually absorbing ideas instead of just reading little synopsis, little cliff note thingies. You know, reading the source of a quote instead of reading somebody's quote on a Facebook page. That to me is what my youth is for, and that's how I intend to continue to use it. So a year from now, on February, was it the 15th?
Whatever it
today?
Is.
16th? I don't even know. We'll reconvene and see how absorbed I am in my phone.
I'll see if I can draw your attention away from the glowing screen in front of you.
Perfect. It's a deal.
Speaking of what I mentioned before, Werner Herzog, had I already gone through the Rogue Film School the last time we did a podcast?
I don't think so. I think it was pending at that time.
So Werner Herzog, who 21% of the people that I talk to are absolutely obsessed with, and the other, 79% have no idea who he is. He's a dude who's made 60 films in 40 years. He's a Bavarian who grew up and didn't see a first television until he was about 15 years old. I think he saw his first movie when he was 11, and he had no idea things like that had even existed. He's fearless. He got to go in and shoot Cave of Forgotten Dreams, which I think I did mention in the last episode.
Mm-hmm, you did, yeah.
And are we sure we didn't talk about this? Maybe I was about to go and do it or something.
Talked about in our year-end movie wrap-up.
There we go.
That's when that came
That's why I was talking about it. Yeah. I couldn't tell you at the time, but I went through his Rogue Film School, which he's done, I think, twice now, and does it completely just when he feels like doing it. He picks a bunch of people out of a lot of submissions and gives them some very deep insight into how he's done what he's done outside of the system.
And by the way, just to be clear,
yeah,
just to be clear, stepping backward for a half a second, when you attend this, you are not allowed to tweet, you're not allowed to blog, you're not allowed to Facebook, you're not allowed to any of that about the experience you have. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
Yeah.
So I can't really divulge all of the things he talks about here. It's not like he's giving us, you know, Swiss bank account numbers or anything, but it's just, it's not going to be processed the same way as it would if you're in the sort of the think tank of people who understand exactly the context of what he's saying. And it's how to get things done. Oh, Newt Gingrich is causing trouble out on Sunset.
So. Straight up.
Yeah. Anyway, so one of the things, so I'm going to probably be quoting little things that he said, insights, because that's why I wanted to give it some context. But basically, he said that in order to be a really, truly great filmmaker, you have to walk, you know, 3,000 steps, 3,000 miles, whatever it was, he said, on foot. I mean, obviously, you walk on foot. Because what you see, he said that walking that is going to be infinitely more educational than 3 years in film school about how to make a film. Now, that's not completely true because I'm glad I studied cinematography. I needed to know some technical facts. But as far as reading books about how to tell great stories or reading about the great myths or whatever, you will get a lot more by observing the details of the reality around you on foot and not by virtue of some pre-digested opinion about it. So you can say, I was down at Sunset today and I did a bunch of stuff, and I can read that tweet and go, oh, so there's traffic on Sunset today. Newt Gingrich is out there. But It's a wholly different thing to be there on foot, having walked from Silver Lake, and start to see the scene collect, the people, the what they're wearing, what their responses are, the people that are having coffee, the birds up on the pole, the broken stoplight, the wrapper from some fast food place on the street, the book that's lying next to it, the abandoned shoe in the middle of the road. These things all tell stories, and they give you a far greater sense of the life that you're actually living in, away from the distilled, purified renditions that simple opinions make.
And that's exactly the point that I was making a second ago. Those are things, like you said, if you just read about it on Twitter, if you get a tweet or something is on someone's Facebook page, you're going to get the information, but you're not going to get that experience. And we sort of touched on it last time, but we didn't really get into it. We talked a little bit about unplugging, and there was someone recently in the news who just unplugged completely, and a big deal was made of it. We can talk about that in a second. But your point, I think the greater kind of aspect of your point is, if you just shut up and pay attention, in your specific case, you're talking about Werner Herzog, talking about how to absorb and appreciate all the elements of a story and see things come together before your eyes.
Well, just to live in the world that you live in.
Yeah. Just take that out of the cinematography class and just pay attention in your everyday life, you know? Pay attention to your parents who annoy you and you can't wait to look at your phone or get online or whatever. Just pay attention to them. Look at the pores on their face, and because we're just walking through scenes on TV shows, you know, with sitcom set. There's your living room, there's your bedroom, there's your job, there's your school, whatever, and we're missing everything else, the true context. Yeah,
everything's
all
so meta right now. I love it.
And so the story about, and I don't remember his name, so this kid just decided to unplug for a couple of months, 5-6 months, whatever it was, and stopped using Twitter, stopped looking at Facebook. And he found himself in a really interesting spot where he actually stopped using his phone too. And so if he wanted to say hello to someone, he would get on his bike, he would ride over to their house, and he would knock on their door. And if they weren't home, he would leave them a note. And then he got into leaving notes with chalk drawings on in front of their houses on their sidewalks. And so people were coming home, and they're saying, well, and I shouldn't say kid, this guy was in his 20s or whatever. They're saying, oh, well, I miss whatever his name was, Johnny. I miss Johnny, but look at this really cool, oh my God, he left me a note. He left me a plant. He left me a stuffed animal. And so by just choosing to not do the simple, convenient thing and reacting to what was coming at him all day, every day, he not only made his experience better, but he brought something uninvited, surprising, genuinely heartfelt, and appreciable into the lives of the people that he cared about. And one of the things that triggered that experience in him is he had a bunch of his friends come into town one weekend, people who he hadn't seen for a long time. And the next thing he knew, there were 5 or 6 of them all sitting around in his living room looking at their iPads and playing with their iPhones and cruising the internet. So there they all were together in the same physical location after months, if not years, being apart. And they weren't spending any time together. And I think that's also very poignant. I think when we talk about unplugging and kind of enhancing your experience and not reacting to what's coming at you and actually being proactive and making other people's experiences better, it's a great example.
Just to get a little esoteric here, but I sometimes always wonder, is this just the natural progression? I mean, I remember in like 1990, 91, where I started to get a sense of this internet thing before there were browsers, and I started thinking, you know, where is this going to go? This may just be that evolutionary step that all the, you know, celebrators of the coming Aquarian age in the 60s thought was going to happen, where we suddenly turn into these luminous beings of nothing but thought and erudition, and we transcend up into the heavens. I thought, maybe this is it. Maybe this is where we separate ourselves from the primordial ooze of the planet and simply go into this like state of data and non-physical interaction with the world. And yeah, we would be sacrificing a lot. Just like a butterfly gives up everything that it was to be a caterpillar. And it has its own new problems and it has its own new diet, you know? And I wondered always about that. And in a way, you know, maybe we can't resist it. Maybe there's nothing we can do, that we're going to have this kind of weird kind of Alzheimer's about what life used to feel like as we switch into this other thing. And I'm not saying that being a butterfly is better. I'm just saying it may be some inevitable thing. And maybe it'll be what helps us to survive the massive floods that will come all over the earth, because we just won't be a part of physicality anymore.
Right.
I mean, there's always that idea that Ray Kurzweil talks about a non-invasive brain scan where you can make a backup of your neural network, of your synaptic network in your brain, and just make a copy of you that can be stored in a hard drive for the rest of time.
Right.
Then what are you? And then what does experience mean? So what we're talking about in this sort of lamenting and adamant way.
Are we lamenting?
Well, I don't know. It sounds a little bit lamenty to me, but I'm just saying maybe what we're talking about is this, the transition or potential transformation from the marriage of a consciousness and a physical body.
Right.
To one where consciousness pretty much disposes of the physical body. God
well,
knows,
let me,
like, robots
let me
don't have
posit
that problem.
This for a second. This I think this maybe will help illuminate a little bit of that. I think the difference is when you're spending your time online, when you're reading tweets, when you're on Facebook, what you're doing is you're reacting because you're looking at something that's already been generated. When you are walking down the street and when you're paying attention to those other details that we were talking about, you are the first man on the scene. You're the boots on the ground. You're the reporter. That's your experience. You are generating your own experience. You're assessing what's important to you. You're storing in that synaptic network and making connections what's most memorable to you and so forth. So you're not reacting. Everything else that you're doing when you're playing with your phone or looking online or whatever is 100% reaction. And the question you just have to ask yourself is, there's nothing wrong with that. Are you the type of person who wants to go through life reacting? Because I'll tell you, the people who are in charge, whether you want to say the big evil white guys who are in charge of corporations or whatever, or just the people who are generating...
That's
the
so racist.
I know. The people who are generating the most interesting ideas, the progenitors of the things today that we'll embrace tomorrow, those are not the people who are sitting around reacting to what's coming at them online.
Well, let me put that a slightly different way. When you're dealing with stuff online, you're usually dealing, it's all on you. You're sort of, it's all about you and you're you. And when you're on the street, it's really not about you. And you sort of are outside of yourself. You know, your ability to influence those things is much more limited. So in fact, things are going to happen at you which you are not controlling, which you are not deciding, which are not based on your sense of expectations or already established experience set. Whereas when you're online, you're not going to encounter anything really that you're not directly asking for.
Right.
So that's what I mean by self-reinforcing kennels, where you're just saying, well, this is my territory and I'm comfortable with this and maybe I'll go exploring, but you're only going to explore what you've already been exposed to because, you know, there you have something like Stumble Upon, which sort of takes you through a bunch of random sites you may not have thought of. But even then, you're putting in some sort of a keyword. And even then, it's a recursive experience built on your past interactions with it. But when you're on the street, things are going to happen that you have no idea about, that you could never have predicted, that an entire billion set of causalities have led to that have nothing to do with you. At all.
Exactly.
And in a way, that's why Herzog said, if you really want to train to be a great filmmaker, become a bar, become a bouncer at a strip joint for a while. And then you'll really see what's up.
Right.
And how things really go down and how right. things really interact. And you'll get out of your precious space. I don't know. I mean, I don't necessarily agree that you have to put yourself in the path of danger and scumminess in order to have experience in life. I think you can also have a beautiful, profound life living out in the prairies of Winnipeg or Alberta, whatever. But, you know, there is something to be said for that you expose yourself or you put yourself into environments where things that are completely out of your control may happen versus keeping yourself within the boundaries of places where you're controlling the entire experience.
Exactly. Well, that's the whole point, I think. The whole point is not to be nostalgic for the way things used to be and not to be nostalgic for Paul McCartney, and he was in the Beatles, the greatest band ever. It's just to not lose touch with what that type of experience means. And again, if for no other reason than just to appreciate where power is generated from, whether it's your own personal power or power in the world around you or power from people who lord it over other people, it's living in that experience and paying attention to that experience. And you're right, you don't have to put yourself in harm's way. Although just driving over here to the studio, I put myself in harm's way. The difference is you just have to strip away the insulation. Have you insulated yourself with your radio in your car? Have you insulated yourself with your phone? Are you not really paying attention to what's going on when they're driving? Try turning all that off and rolling down your windows and listening to the street and smelling the street. And when you're stopped at a stoplight, instead of firing off that text that's so important before the light changes, look around, look to your left and right, look at the homeless guy, look at the cute girl, look at the person in the other car picking their nose. Like, all of that stuff all kind of goes into this giant stew. And you're 100% correct. You have to choose out of that experience, because you can't control it, what to integrate into yourself and what to make important and carry forward with you, because it's just way too much. But when you're just looking at a screen, like you said, you might tumble through some websites you never thought of before, but it's really a limited experience. I mean, you can kind of do it sleepwalking.
There is an article in Wired magazine about an organization called UX that exists in Paris. And what these guys do, these guys are rogues and vigilantes who are very experienced craftsmen and tradesmen and women. And they have found each other and allowed new members in after careful observation. And what they do is they go to old artifacts, buildings, structures, mechanisms throughout Paris by way of the underground, for which they have a map, and they repair them. They restore clocks, massive tower clocks. They fix gates and locks to historic buildings, and sometimes have been prosecuted by the very owners of the objects or the very alleged caretakers of these objects, because they don't know how to react. There's something really poignant about that for me, metaphorically, about fixing things in the world that need to be fixed without any hope of being paid back for it or even acknowledgement, just so that they are there for a future generation. That was what was profound for me about that story. That it's not even the fact that they're going to save the world by doing so. They're just fixing a freaking clock or restoring an old film projector and then putting it back in the museum where they found it.
Right.
But it's the fact that the people that are presently in charge of taking care of that for whatever wage they're being paid are being negligent and not doing the job. Get it? Like, we have to do that too.
Well, we have to remember, again, not nostalgia, but let's just keep in touch with doing things for the sake of doing that thing itself and not because you're going to get compensated in some way. Like, I think you find a lot of people today saying, well, I could do this thing, but what's the remuneration for me? What am I going to get out of it? Whether it's a favor or a paycheck or a free meal or a blowjob or whatever. And, oh, I'm not going to get any of those things, so therefore I'm just not going to do this because I value my skill set so highly. And so you're right, here are these people who, now granted, there's something perverse about them sneaking around in the sewers and the ill-used underground tunnels below Paris to do what they're doing. They're definitely getting a self.
They're really a bunch of weirdos.
Yeah, there's a self-satisfying thrill in doing that, and then sneaking into buildings through sewer grates and disused basements to go repair a clock or to have a film screening in an old Roman amphitheater or something that's been bricked over the years and doing things like that. So it's not like they're doing it for the goodness, but they're not doing it specifically just to get something back because they're anonymous. And so nobody's ever going to go, hey, Joe, that's great what you did with that clock. You know, they really, truly are just doing it for themselves and for the act of the thing itself.
It's like graffiti artists.
Right, exactly.
I interviewed Risk, who's a pretty well-known graffiti artist. He's done stuff for Michael Jackson and for the Chili Peppers and a whole bunch of corporations, MTV back in the day. And the cool thing about him, incidentally, was that when MTV wanted to hire him, he said, okay, but I'm not going to paint MTV. I'm going to paint Risk. If you want somebody to do MTV, then go hire some graphic designer somewhere. Because it's all about the tag. It's kind of the opposite in a weird way of the UX, in the sense that a graffiti artist is all about the tag. It's all about that throw up that has their name, fame, infamy, getting it higher up than the last guy, crossing out the guy below you, you know. But it's the same kind of thing.
It comes from the same place.
Yeah.
It comes from the same place.
There's kind of a perverse excitement and satisfaction that comes from the love of doing it for its own sake. Because
right.
as a graffiti artist, you can't really just go out and be like, hey, here I am, because here come the handcuffs.
Right.
And, you know, the vandalism charges and the trespassing charges and everything else. So
but again,
you're
if you want
incredible art at your cost, at your, you know, you're spending lots of cash on spray cans.
Sure.
And you're putting up art on the walls, but nobody wants you to do it, just like nobody wants the UX to go and repair their clock towers.
Right. Yeah, they couldn't, if they wanted to, in that particular example, if they wanted to approach them and say, we can fix your clock and we can come in and we'll do it and it won't cost anything, the answer is 100% no. And so the only way that could get done was by them doing it stealthily, completely under the radar at odd hours and just doing it that way. And again, I brought it up before, but if you want to go back to looking at things in terms of a power perspective, Outliers, which pretty much everyone is familiar with, that book is rife with stories about people who just did stuff for the sake of the thing that they were doing on the fringes of the mainstream in their individual fields, whether it was writing code or playing music, or
they were hackers.
They were hackers.
Or they were
on
punk
the fringe,
rockers.
And they were just doing it to do it, man. And you look at Shepard Fairey now, here's a guy who was just for the sake of art and the sake of the graffiti art experience. Here's a guy who's got money and a clothing line, and he did half the wall of the new West Hollywood Library, which opened a couple months ago. He's got a giant mural there.
The MoCA had a serious art exhibition about graffiti artists about a year and a half ago. And, you know, what's interesting about that is that nobody would have even been exposed to those artists had they not painted the sides of buildings without permission.
Right.
Nobody would have gone out to see their quiet little gallery in the gentrified part of town and say, oh, goodness, this is just lovely spray painting going on the wall here. So maybe this is the rogue episode.
I think this episode's about five different things.
It's about rogues and archaeologists, I think.
I think look to the past, let that inform your future, because the majority of people around you are not paying attention to the past right now. And if you want to take ideas that you can mine and reinvent and turn them on their head and create something new that's singularly yours and be original, and by doing so become successful and get power from that particular situation, you're going to be ahead of the game versus just reacting to what's coming at you.
So what's next for you, Truffle? You going to be painting any walls in the near future?
I don't know that I'm going to be painting any walls.
Riding any dirigibles?
I think there's going to be some outstanding and outlandish experiences in my very near future.
Excellent.
Which we'll look forward to talking about.
On Facebook.
On Facebook.
No, I didn't mean it. You can follow the Karamcast on Twitter at Karamcast, KERAMCAST. You can follow me on Twitter at K Maliki Sanchez. And we are online at thekaramcast.com. That's karamcast.com, where you can download all of our previous episodes, sign up to be on our email newsletter, and look at pretty pictures of pretty things. Thanks to Truffle Jones for joining us. Been good having
you
these last few episodes, and I hope we can do it again in the future.
Lots of fun, anytime.
The same thing over and over and over. Everything over and over and over again. The same thing over and over and over again. The same thing over and over again. Every. last thing over and over and over, over and over and over again. The same thing. Every the same thing over and over, the same thing. Over and over and over, same thing. Every same thing over and over and over, the same thing. Over and over and over and over and over again.